From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's remarkable that a man who grew up under a night sky muted by the lights of a huge city would come to be obsessed by space. But Neil deGrasse Tyson's obsession didn't come from the few stars he could make out in the sky above his Bronx neighborhood, but from his first visit to New York's Hayden Planetarium when he was 9. He still remembers it. It was one of those star shows that caught his attention, and for the first time he saw the impossible brilliance of the Milky Way. That was the moment, he said, he knew he would become an astrophysicist. Tyson became the director of that planetarium and one of the country's most vocal proponents of space exploration. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his personal relationship with the cosmos and his crusade to get America back into space. Neil deGrasse Tyson, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For years now, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson has been making the case for space exploration. There are the tangible benefits that he mentions, the breakthroughs in science and technology, the economic effects. But there's also something more abstract in the case he makes. It's about culture, the glory of discovery. That's harder to measure, but he says space drives our sense of adventure. It influences the way we take on the challenges of the future. Just look what happened, for example, he's mentioned, when we first saw a photo of Earth from space. He's talked about the organization Doctors Without Borders. He's talked about the Clean Water Act, the banning of DDT, the Clean Air Act. All of that happened in the wake of seeing that image. Today in the program, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is joining us to talk about his own relationship with the cosmos and his crusade to get America back into space. Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist. He's also a director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. He's the host of Star Talk. It's a podcast that explores science's impact on pop culture. We'll give you a link to that, by the way. He's the author, of course, of several books, including The Pluto Files, Death by Black Hole, and The Sky is Not the Limit. His latest book is called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. And Dr. Tyson is joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Happy to be with you here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin by having you explain your sort of personal connection to space. And I'm wondering just how much of the night sky you could really see in the Bronx when you were growing
Bronx,
up.
Bronx, New York City, yeah.
Yeah.
You catch about a dozen stars, you know, on a good night, maybe 15. You can see the planets, the moon, and, of course, the sun.
Yeah.
And actually, that gets you pretty far. You know, there's quite a bit of viewing to take place with the planets. If you get a telescope, even in the middle of New York City, you can see the moons of Jupiter, even the bands across its surface, indicating sort of weather differences from one sort of latitude on its surface, in its gaseous atmosphere to another. That Saturn's ring system and the moon, you see the craters and valleys and hills and mountains on the moon. And so the night sky can come alive, but you're just limited to how many things you can check out.
Yeah, but were you really, before you went to the Hayden Planetarium when you were 9, which was an important moment for you, were you really paying much attention to it?
No, not at all. Yeah. In fact, I think most New Yorkers at any age, don't pay attention to the night sky. It doesn't call attention to itself. As the sun sets, which can be quite beautiful in the cityscape for sure, then it starts to get dark, but then the city turns on its lights. And so the city becomes your distraction, not the night sky. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you grew up on a farm, you know, the sun sets and the sky comes out. So you have a different relationship to the night if you grow up in rural America than if you grow up in the city.
Yeah. So you went to the star show. You were 9 at the Hayden.
Yeah. I was 9 years old. It was a family trip, and we went. And by the way, my family went to a different sort of cultural institution or cultural offering every weekend. So we'd go to an art museum or the zoo or the we even go to, you know, ball games or the opera or Broadway. The musicals and plays. So they felt it was important that we be exposed to all the ways that humans, adult humans, can express their creative energies. And so for me, that first trip to the Hayden Planetarium, when the stars, you know, you walk into this odd room, right? It's round, and the room is round. Your ceiling is not flat; it's a dome. They dim the lights, and the stars come out, and it brings a gasp every time, especially for New Yorkers who walk in there. And for me, that gasp was the universe coming down out of the sky into me. Like, I don't think I had any choice in the matter. I think the universe selected me. It was not I who selected the universe. Because then on, I was kind of imprinted with this exposure to the night sky. In fact, I thought it was a hoax.
Yeah.
I said, oh, this is fine, you know, all these thousands of stars. I'll go along with it for now. And it would be later that I would discover, in fact, a trip to Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania, where, you know, we pulled over on the side of the road and there was the night sky as only I had ever seen it, it portrayed in the Hayden Planetarium. To this day, when I see night skies such as that from mountaintops and all the best viewing spots of the world, I still think, you know, this sickeningly urban perspective that, oh, it reminds me of the Hayden Planetarium.
Which was fake, you know? I mean,
Yeah. The fake thing reminds me of the real thing reminds me of the fake thing.
Yeah.
And that's because of I was imprinted by it.
Yeah.
And it would take a couple of years before I would know and understand. You know, 9, you're pretty young.
Yeah.
But by 11, I knew if you came up to me and said, what do you want to be when you grow up, as that annoying question that adults always ask kids, my answer was astrophysicist. Just look at it. I have a book that is called Neil's School Years, and all my report cards are in there, and teacher comments, and the names of my close friends, and all of this. And in there, it says, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I'll tell you how old that little book collection is. It's split. What you want it to be when you grow up? The boys and the girls.
Right.
So the girls, I want to be a nurse, a stewardess, a secretary, and the boys could be a soldier or a fireman, policeman, and so. Astrophysicist. Well, but there was a fill in your own.
Yeah.
And so I put in astrophysicist.
So your family wandered around the city to different cultural
essentially
events,
taking
things in. So what was the expectation for you?
I don't think that it wasn't that kind of household.
Huh.
It wasn't, we're going to make sure our kid. No, it was just, here's the world.
Yeah.
However you intersect with you and however you respond to it, let it be what it is. And so it was much more hands-off, much more let us create the situation where you might shine, but let's not tell you that this is when you must shine. And there are a lot of families, I think, where the parents have expectations on their kids, either goals that they never reached when they were growing up, or goals that they did reach and they want their kids to follow in their footsteps. There was no such pressure on our household growing up. My parents are still alive. They're like 84 and 83. And they're some of the most rational people I know in terms of decision-making with regard to life and society and culture.
So what's the lesson you take from that? Just kids will discover. You need to back off?
Oh, yeah. So kids, I can't tell you how many times people ask me, how do I get my kids interested in science? Just like get out of their way.
Yeah.
First, kids are naturally curious. So the very act that we were exposed to different things was a way to continue to feed what is a native curiosity of children. And what you don't want to do is watch a child being curious, and sometimes sometimes it frankly just breaks stuff. The kid goes into the refrigerator, finds the eggs, right? And starts playing with the eggs. And what's the first thing you do as a parent? Don't play with the egg. That's food. You'll break it.
Yeah.
When the act of playing with the egg, for me, is an experiment in gravity. It's an experiment in material science where the egg is brittle, so it breaks when it falls. And then the egg opens up, and there's a whole biology lesson in there. That thing becomes a chicken embryo, that yolky stuff. So yes, it makes a mess, but let the experiment run its course. And what did that cost you in the case of the egg? 20 cents, 25 cents? The president of Harvard once said, Derek Bach, former president of Harvard, once said, if you think education is expensive, try the cost of ignorance.
You know, I get the part where you were inspired and you wanted to do that. I understand that part of it. You wanted to explore and discover and learn But it's interesting. I learned about this. You did this hour-long lecture to this continuing education class when you were 15 years old.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. By then, I was already so into the universe. I had my telescope. I was already on my second telescope, funded, by the way, by revenue earned by walking dogs.
Yeah.
You know, I lived in a huge apartment complex. And, you know, these are city dogs that don't, you know, some of them don't even walk stairs. So it's hard to convey this fact to people who have, you know, country dogs. This, you know, it's like the country mouse and the city mouse. City dogs are different, right? That's all I got to tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
Another, just quick, has got nothing to do with anything. City dogs hardly ever bark at you because they're just too many people.
Yeah.
If you're walking the suburban street past a yard and the dog sees you, it's going to run out and bark at you, right? But in the city, I'm sure they tried the first couple of days they got here, but there's just too many people. And so dogs are pretty relatively silent, given how many there are in the city.
But,
so I'd walk dogs for
a
living,
yeah.
And I used the money to buy my telescope. And with that telescope, I'd gone on an expedition. I'd been to the Mojave Desert to a special astronomy camp for, like, nerdy middle schoolers and early high schoolers. And I'd amassed a set of photographs of the night sky. Astrophotography is always beautiful at any level, even if it's done at an amateur scale. And this is, I'll tell you how long ago this was. Comet Kohoutek was on its way towards the inner solar system, and there was great anticipation for it because it was to come around during Christmas. Turns out to have been a bust. It didn't brighten as much as our predictions held for it, but it got people thinking and talking about comets in the solar system and pretty things in the night sky. So I was invited by the adult extension school of City College to come and give a guest lecture. They had heard about my work, and I was teaching adults, you know, and it was great. And then later on, I got a check in the mail.
Yeah,
they paid me to do that. And it was like $50. This is 1973. I am 14, just turned 15 years old, and somebody hands me a $50 check for talking about the universe. And I said, whoa, this is not even right. I didn't sweat. I didn't toil. There was no bloodshed. And it was hard for me to reconcile just doing what I loved with the fact that someone was prepared to pay me to do it.
See, this is the thing that was interesting, though. It wasn't just about keeping this stuff to yourself. It seems like what's really critical, and you've said this, you've said talking about the universe was like breathing.
Oh,
so,
yes.
So the critical part is sharing the stuff that you learn.
It's like asking someone to describe your bedroom or describe your living room or describe your backyard, you know, describe the universe.
Yeah.
So this was, for me, it was no different. And so but another aspect of this is, I think there's a quote that I think originated with Carl Sagan, where he said, when you're in love, you want to tell the world.
Right.
And my relationship with the universe was such that how could I keep that contained?
Mm.
How could I not tell other people how amazing Saturn is? By the way, it had nothing to do with my love for the universe. It had to do with the universe itself.
Mm.
And I wanted to alert others of how extraordinary these objects of my affection were, on the possibility that they might then share that level of affection. I would later learn that no, not everyone shares this level of affection, but they would. I could nonetheless get people excited, you know, without much effort, right? Because I at the end of the day, I got good material. You know, I'm talking about the universe here. So, you know, I think it's not an accident that some of the most known science popularizers throughout the last century have focused on the universe.
Mm.
Even Brian Cox, who I'm told is more popular in the UK than Carl Sagan ever was in America. He's a physicist, a particle physicist. But what are the shows that he does that makes it to America? The Wonders of the Solar System, Wonders of the Universe, and Carl Sagan himself, and a lot of what I'm doing, most of what I'm doing. So we've all got good material. There it is.
What do you figure it is about our species that is interested in space, in the sense that do you think that we kind of evolved to have a fascination for it, or not a fear of it, but
a curiosity?
Why do you figure we're drawn to it?
Yeah, I haven't done the experiment, and it's kind of fun once you already know the answer to sort of make up a reason why it might be so. So here's my invented reason for why it might be so. You know, humans, among all mammals and perhaps among most animals in general, are perfectly comfortable sleeping on our backs.
Yeah.
All right? I don't know any other animal. I mean, dogs will do it, but dogs, you know. Wolves, I don't know if wolves sleep on their back. Domestic dogs will sleep on their back. Humans will sleep on our backs, and we sleep at night. So consider the following. If at night you wake up, you see the night sky. If we slept facing down and you woke up, you'd be looking at dirt. Most animals wake up and look at dirt. When we wake up in the middle of the night, for whatever reason, we can see the sky. And the sky has the moon and planets and bright light comets and the color changes and the tapestry of twilight. And you see the patterns and the and you know, the sun is in the daytime, and at night the sun sets at different parts of the horizon. Things change. The planets move. They get brighter and dimmer. They go one direction and then another. Backwards would be retrograde. So I think that the act of waking up in the middle of the night just confronted us with the night sky and left us wondering what the hell is going on up there. And now, I don't know if that, it has to promote your survival in order for it to be genetically encoded within us. And I haven't quite figured out how that would necessarily be the case. But I can, well, it could be that the people who were where that stimulated their curiosity, they went out and explored. And when you explore, you discover new resources, you discover new places, you discover new ways to live. By the way, you also discover new ways to die. So the two almost go hand in hand. But in the end, you take the risks because the benefits so far outweigh them. And those are the ones who would then propagate their genes. So this is my invented answer for why that might
be so. It sounds good to me.
But regardless, I can tell you that every culture in the history of the human species has looked up and wondered, what is it all about? What's up there? Why are we here? And where is it all going?
What are the things that you've written, and it's included in the new book, is that you write about these emotive forces that drive the human species. And you write that some of humankind's most creative leaps are decidedly primal. Irrational is the word you use.
Oh, yeah. In fact, if every discovery was a simple derivation from what you knew before, we would never, whole new branches of our understanding of the universe would have never unfolded. It takes an abject act of creativity. You know, not to overuse the phrase, but there's everybody in the box. You have to step out of the box. Not with both feet, because then we just lose you. One foot out of the box. You got to remember, like, where the other foot is. Yeah. Otherwise, I can't help you, all right? So one foot out of the box that wanders, one hand, one eye, and then you see there's a new way to think about things. There's a broader understanding of our known universe. And then you explore this. You bring it to bear. Experiment to bear on those ideas, and then you extend human understanding of the universe. This is a very natural unfolding of cosmic discovery, or discovery in any of the sciences. So not to belittle the fact that many discoveries are derived from previous understandings, no doubt about it, but the greatest discoveries come from just abject intellectual leaps that could come from anything. Could be like you're in the bathroom, you're in the shower, you get hit on the head with something. Well, it doesn't matter. It's now, by the way, it's, you don't get these great ideas unless you already understand how the universe works.
Yeah.
All right. So if you don't know anything about the universe and you get hit in the head and say, I have an idea.
No.
You know, Earth is, you know, doesn't orbit the sun. You know, I'm sorry, you're wrong.
Yeah.
It needs some anchoring. That's the one foot that's still in the box that matters there.
But you've talked about your effort, and we'll get into this as we go, but your effort to get America back into space, but as not as something new, but as you trying to get the country back into, it seems like back into that mindset that we had before. You've called it resurrecting old habits and behaviors that seem to have fallen by the wayside. And I guess my question is, are we thinking about discovery in different ways? Are we jaded in some way? Why aren't we thinking in those same modes?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. Let me just preface that by saying we live in a free country, and Congress are elected officials of districts and of states. And so at no time do I see myself on a crusade to get us back into space. Whether or not it looks that way, that's not how I feel about it. The way I feel about it is there are things people simply don't know, and they should know.
Yeah.
Before they make any decision about who they vote for, what they vote for, how they formulate their ideas about America's future, about the future of our species. And so as an educator and as a scientist, it's incumbent upon me to make sure that people understand how this world works and the causes and effects and the consequences of creative investments in science and engineering on our economy.
Yeah.
And on the dreams of a nation, and the correspondence between those dreams and enabling them, and the force that that then brings to bear on our fiscal stability going forward. I expose people to this. Once you learn it, if you still choose to vote differently, it's a free country. I'm not going to twist your arm. Just understand the consequences. We will slide backwards relative to the rest of the nations who understand the value of investments in science and technology. In this, the 21st century, where innovations in science and technology are the engines of tomorrow's economy. And we know that NASA, when it innovates, affects a culture of innovations even when it's not NASA. And NASA, when it innovates, is essentially a flywheel of stored innovative energy that industry and our culture taps to bring tomorrow's dreams into the present. So it's a point that I'm making, but I'm not gonna march on Washington. That's not what I do.
It's interesting. I mean, you look at other countries over the past 10 years or so. China sends its first astronaut in 2003.
Just when they said they were going to do it.
Yeah.
India
is training astronauts. The first European Union sent a moon probe, 2004. You've got Brazil and Israel and Iran and South Korea, Ukraine, Canada, France, Germany.
They understand the role of space exploration on the attitude of a culture towards inventing tomorrow.
All right, so what's wrong with us?
Forgot about it.
Forgot.
Okay? Now, here's the thing. I think I understand why we forgot. Because when we went to the moon, it was not driven by an urge to boost the economy. It was driven by war.
Right.
It was not driven by any other lofty reason we remember that era to be. It was not driven by, oh, Kennedy had charisma. Oh, it's in our DNA as Americans. Oh, it is the natural thing to explore. Sure, you know, Columbus was an explorer. Mm. But the people who wrote the check had geopolitical motives. And the history of check writing tells me that when you want to do something big and expensive, the simple urge to want to explore is never sufficient to get the check written. The check writers are interested in security, war, defense, that sort of thing. They're interested in the growth of economic wealth, as was Ferdinand and Isabella with Columbus and with Magellan. They're interested in those two things above all else. And while you can have a funding level below the radar where, yeah, you'll do science,
yeah,
right? The Hubble telescope was just at the threshold of a funding level where science drove those expenditures. But when it gets more expensive than that, if it doesn't satisfy a war driver or an economic driver, it is susceptible to getting cut, as it happens essentially every time that I've read in the history of the funding of human projects, of cultural projects.
So are you saying, so we need, I mean, you've talked about those drivers. You've talked about the economic return driver. You've talked about the fact that I don't want to die driver, which we can talk about.
Yes, I don't want to die, and I don't want to die poor.
And, right. Right. And then there's the praise of gods and royalty driver, which I'm not
right.
sure is in place as much anymore. But so what is the thing? It's economics that's going to drive us. So we don't have a Soviet Union now, which drove the space race in the 60s.
Yeah. So
what's the driver today?
I lost track of the thrust of your question. So in the 1960s, we went to the moon because we were at war, not for any other reason. But when you innovate, you invent new technologies, you dream about tomorrow. That was the 1960s. That had like the World's Fair in New York was all about making tomorrow come. And so you combine all these forces and you say to yourself, oh, look at how much we gained by that investment in spite of having it having been driven by going to war. And so then we stop going to the moon, those investments stop, and the growth of the economy slows decade by decade from the 1960s into the 2000s. And when I can define growth by sort of GDP per capita at the end of the decade minus that at the beginning, divided by the total, you know, so the fractional change of your GDP decade by decade slowed from the 1960s onward. And so you can say, well, what's going on? Yeah. Well, it was big enough at the time that we were coasting. We coasted from the 1970s into the 80s and a little bit into the 90s. And then we had the bubble, you know, the real estate bubble and then the tech bubble. But my point is that if you don't understand the causes and effects of your actions, then you're not in a position to offer a solution to recover from them. And so people did not think of space as pumping the economy. They just didn't. They thought we did it because of glory or because of war, but it also pumped the economy. So all I'm saying is, let's go into space without the war, and it'll doubly pump the economy because now you're not actually spending on war, a cold war and a hot war, as we did back in the 1960s, simultaneously.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is with us. He's an astrophysicist, the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. He's the author of several books, including his newest. It's called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. We're talking about, well, a number of things. He's got a new book out. It's called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Let's take a call from David, who's in Salt Lake City. David, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Hey, thank you for including me in this conversation.
Sure.
My father was in the aerospace industry from its very inception following World War II. He worked with von Braun and other rocketry pioneers up through the moon program and eventually became project engineer for the solid propellant rocket program for the space shuttle after the Challenger disaster. He kind of got that program back online. And what I would say, and what I think is so crucial about what Mr. Tyson is saying, is that for my dad, his entire career, it was never about the next space shuttle mission. It was never about the next moonshot. It was all about the kinds of innovation that can come out of this sort of, you know, almost crazy thinking. Some of the stuff my dad worked on was amazing. I was privy to stuff that other people just weren't privy to because it was around the dinner table. We got to talk about all this amazing stuff. And so it is so critical what this man is saying about what can come out of this kind of thinking. And I'll take comments off the air, but I just want to say I really think this is an amazing conversation and just crucial to how we develop as a nation. And I thank you so much for letting me on.
David, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the caller's comments. And just a point that I haven't made yet, but I had planned to, but this is as good a time as any. The fact that your father talked about innovation around the dinner table is part of the force that NASA imparts upon the rest of culture. Because now you grew up in an innovation household. It was natural to you that, of course, when I grew up, I'm going to grow up into a world where people are going to think about new ways to do things and dream of new futures that the technological and scientific innovations will enable or empower. So it's not just the widget that came out of a NASA innovation. It is the culture of innovation that pervades all of society. And that culture, whether or not you're an actor, a comedian, a journalist, a politician, if you are embedded in that culture, no matter your profession, yes, the scientists and engineers and technologists will engage in that innovative culture. But even if you're not, you become a participant in that culture in ways that influence who you vote for, or what pressures you will put on your elected representatives for how they spend money, and what kind of world you want to live in, because you want to make tomorrow come. And that's the culture that we are absent today. No one is thinking about tomorrow. No one is dreaming about tomorrow. I can't tell you how long it's been since I've seen a magazine article extolling the city of tomorrow, the transportation of tomorrow. Yeah. Those are all they all ended in the mid-1970s after we stopped going to the moon.
So that's the key. That's why no one talks about tomorrow. It's because we're not out there exploring anymore.
Yes. If NASA were out exploring in a big way, unlike what the shuttle was, but the shuttle was a engineering frontier in the construction of the space station. It's an extraordinary piece of hardware orbiting up there, you know, the area of a football field. But it was not advancing a space frontier. It was, as I've said, boldly going where hundreds had gone before. You want to advance a space frontier, you have to go a little farther tomorrow than you did today. You have to have a different kind of challenge that you encounter in space tomorrow than you do today. And that advancing of a frontier is the so it's not just simply being in space. It is the constant pushing of that frontier that transforms the culture in which you live.
You write in your book that it was I think it was around 2004, you say, when you first started really to notice this partisan bias that was, as you put it, distorting people's space sensibilities. And you've talked about the fact that, you know, until quite recently, space exploration was above party politics. Now, how are you seeing it?
Yeah, so here's what happened, as best as I can judge it. And I write about this in the opening chapter, which is called Space Politics.
Yeah.
By the way, politics has always surrounded space, so I'm not so naive as to think that let's get politics out of space. That's just naive.
Yeah.
NASA was birthed in a geopolitical climate,
right.
Period. We were spooked by Sputnik. And a year and a day later, we founded NASA. Or a year later, NASA was founded. And so let's be honest with ourselves about that first. Second, NASA had never been partisan up until, I think, 2004, in the sense that if you either supported NASA or did not, you could not use that as a judge of whether you were left or right or Democrat or Republican or Libertarian. It didn't heavily correlate. And there were no sort of positions of one party or another regarding space destinations or NASA budget. So in that regard, plus NASA had 10 centers scattered in 8 states across the country. States, many of the states are swing states, including Ohio, with its NASA Glenn Center, as well as in Florida, which is Kennedy Space Center itself. So NASA was sort of politically spread. Now, what happens now in 2004 is you get so George Bush actually becomes president in 2001, and NASA is not on the table really because we got attacked, right? We're in a bad way from September 11th. But then the Chinese launch their Taikonaut in 2003. President Bush initiates a new space vision statement. I actually get appointed to that commission to study how to implement that. And I noticed that Bush is so thoroughly hated by the left political spectrum. I mean, in a really visceral way, that anything Bush said was objected to by the left. And it was like, wow, I'd never seen that before. That was like amazing to me to watch that happen. And so when Bush said, let's go to Mars, you have to look at the left press. I quote some of it in that opening chapter.
Yeah.
They say, oh, let's send Bush to Mars. You know, that's where he should go. He's totally out of it. And when Kennedy says, let's go to the moon, everyone says, oh, he's visionary. Yeah. Right. So this bias was extraordinary from my view. And Then Obama gets elected in 2008. There's a huge right-wing contingent that hates Obama. And so no matter what Obama says, especially in this 24/7 news talk format, no matter what he says, people hate it. And so here's people just trying to make NASA work. And there's a partisan divide that opened up in the last 10 years. And it concerned me greatly because NASA had a hard enough time getting the funding it needed. Now I've got to get through a partisan divide just to sustain it. And so that's why I say, forget any of this. What matters here is what role NASA plays on the wealth of the nation. And that's something everybody can agree on, no matter your political stripe.
It's interesting the way, of course, now Newt Gingrich during a Republican debate mentions, a prospective moon colony. And I guess the same thing plays out. And I think what's interesting is you sort of weighed in on the subject. And it's interesting to see the sort of press on the left had one interpretation of what you had said.
Yeah,
press on the right had another one.
It was hilarious. So there's Gingrich. I mean, NASA came up every now and then in the debates, but it really came up when they were in Florida. All the Republican hopefuls were in Florida because Florida is Space Coast, at least the part of Florida that's Space Coast really matters to the economy. Excuse me, to the economy of Florida. And Florida is like leads the nation in home foreclosures. So if you're going to talk economy in Florida, it better be in a way that matters. And so Gingrich took the opportunity to say, let's have a moon colony. And then he quipped about getting some threshold of people. I forgot the numbers at 13,000 on the moon, and then declare it a 51st state.
Right.
It was actually really funny. But that comment was not attached to his campaign pledge that he wants to put a colony on the moon by the end of his second term. Yet when the liberal press got a hold of it, they stapled those two pieces together, which then made it look that much more comical. But he just simply said, I want to put a moon colony there by the end of my second term. And I got called on to my book had just come out.
Yeah.
Right. This is only a month ago. Right.
Right.
It had just come out. So everybody's called. My phone is ringing off the hook. The conservative press, liberal press, Republican. And so I comment and I said, you know, moon colony is not as it's not even as visionary as Kennedy saying, let's walk on the moon in the next 8 years.
Right.
Because when he said that, we didn't even have a launch vehicle that wasn't going to kill one of our astronauts. And 8 years later, we walk on the moon. So here it is today. We've already been to the moon. He's just saying, let's put a colony there. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
Yet, so I comment on this. No. So then they ask me, well, so how does he plan to get it done? And that's when I criticized it. I said, I don't think he understands the actual causes and effects of how you make that happen. Then I gave my spiel about the economic drivers and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so the headlines were in the blogosphere and in all the commentary on this, the liberal commenting was Tyson shoots down the Gingrich moon proposal. And then the conservative press says Tyson sympathizes with the Gingrich moon proposal. So, you know, I'm tired of this. So I just try to lift myself up above it all and bring forth in view of the far left and the far right fundamental dimensions of NASA that everybody can buy into, that are not simply bipartisan but are nonpartisan, because right now the health of and wealth of this nation matters. And we're sliding compared to the rest of the world. And the recipe, the solution to this, the flywheel of innovation from which we can all draw from emotionally, psychologically, and physically is sitting right in front of our noses, and nobody realizes it.
You know, Gingrich said something interesting about he wanted to accomplish this by the end of his second term. And for you, that's an important point. Because if you look at President Obama's 30-year vision for NASA, I mean, you talk about if a president, if it's going to promise something beyond their presidency, that they're unaccountable for it. And that's an important point for you.
Yeah, exactly. So if you look at Kennedy, he said, we'll go to the moon before the decade is out. All right. So had he gotten a second term, basically we would have landed under his watch. All right. There was a delay with the Apollo 1 fire. We delayed, I think it was almost 2 years, a 22-month delay. But basically, we were going to land on the moon under his watch, and so as a two-term president. And yet, now we have Obama. Actually, Obama's criticized for, like, gutting NASA. That's not really true. He's not topping up NASA But he's not really gutting it. There's been a redistribution of monies within the budget that favored some projects over another, and Mars loses in that contest, by the way, which I think is bad, and I just think we should double NASA's budget to end all this debate. But Obama says, let's go to Mars and land there and send humans to Mars by the 2030s. And I'm thinking, you know, so I applauded that because what president, you know, how many times does a president get to say, let's go to Mars? But then later on that night, I said, wait a minute, where's he going to be in the 2030s? He's like on the beach in Hawaii in the 2030s, right? So this is a president to be named later on budget money is not yet identified. He's making a promise. Right. And so the accountability just simply isn't there. And for me, that's not good enough if we're going to be serious about this investment. And you're not going to tell me we can't afford it. Of course we can afford it. The entire TARP bailout was more than the entire running 50-year budget of NASA. The military spends in a year what NASA spends in its entire when we're fighting a war, its entire 50-year budget. We have the money. It's just a matter of what you choose to do with it. And if you view the half a penny on the dollar, I say double it to a penny, view that as an investment in our future wealth, then you just do it because it pays back later, not only culturally and emotionally and intellectually, but financially.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is with us. His latest book is called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. We need to take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. His latest book is called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Chris is with us in Salt Lake. Chris, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask Neil about his views on the importance of designing missions that send actual human beings into space versus unmanned robotic missions, especially considering how much more complicated and costly that makes everything.
Yeah, how important is it to have a human?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so here's the way I see it. We don't ask where to go next in space. What we do is we create a suite of launch vehicles with some combinations of booster, different configurations of boosters. But all of space becomes our backyard in the presence of that set of launch technologies. And so you might say, well, let's go to the moon or let's visit an asteroid because, in fact, one of them may be headed our way. Oh, let's go to Mars or Phobos and Deimos, one of the moons of Mars. Your motive for going could be scientific. It could be geopolitical. It could be touristic. It could even be exploitive. You might want to mine the moon, for example. But all of these options are then available to you, and each one of those, in order to accomplish them, advances a frontier. When it's an investment, the cost is not the issue here. All that matters is you're advancing a frontier, patents gets issued, and because it's a government money on that first round of how to get something done, patents get issued. Later on, you would cede what becomes routine to private enterprise, but the advancing, which Newt Gingrich had gotten wrong, by the way, he thinks private enterprise can lead an expensive, dangerous frontier with uncertain risk. That's just false. It has never happened in the history of the world. It will never happen unless you change the rules of what free market is. And so what happens is if one of them is scientific, if scientists say, well, we'd rather send a robot, then we just send a robot. I mean, it's that simple. And yes, humans are more expensive than robots, and humans usually want to come back. With robots, you can send them and leave them there. And so, but I'm not going to distinguish between the two in terms of the need to innovate, to have to do something different tomorrow than you did today. It is true. If I wore only a pure science hat and if space exploration were only about science, I would say you would never send people, just send a robot because we can control robots. If I sent a human to study a rock, they'd probably bring a black box anyway and turn on a switch. Well, we can get a robot to do that. So if it was only about science, no doubt about it. You'd never send people. But space has never only been about science. In fact, the fraction of NASA's budget given unto science, the historical average of that is about a fourth.
Yeah.
All the rest has been the manned program driven by geopolitical forces. It's high time we have it be driven by economic forces.
And isn't part of the point that we can't fully explore the universe by being earthbound? We've got to get into space?
Telescopes get you pretty far. I mean, you know, consider what we know about the universe, the edge of the universe, for having never been there.
Mm.
If you sidestep the economic argument, because I think that's the strongest, like I said, nobody wants to die poor. Even if you don't like space, even if you hate NASA, even if you are the least curious person in the world and cosmic discovery is not romantic to you, you don't want to die poor. So I'm saying here's a way to not die poor. And so I happen to love doing it because I'm enchanted by it and I'm romanced by it. And I think that's the noblest reason to do it rather than to just make a buck at the end of the day. By the way, the jobs going overseas now, everyone say, well, let's change the tariff or give tax incentives to the companies. These are tiny Band-Aids over the, oh, we need more science students. Well, let's make better science teachers. That's Band-Aids. All right. That doesn't actually solve the underlying problem. Because when the students get out, where are they going to apply their science interest? We've got nothing for them to do. And the jobs are going overseas because the rest of the world has caught up with us. And they can do our jobs for less than we can. If you innovate, then you create jobs that can't go overseas because no one's figured out how to do it yet. And you keep innovating because even as they catch up, you say, fine, go ahead, we'll make this overseas. We got something else we're building here that only we know how to make. And you can't pretend like you're in a global economy and then be shocked that a company whose sole job is to bring returns to their investors chooses to put a factory overseas. You can't then cry foul, yet still want it to be a global company. So the way around that is, not by putting some new tariff regulation on the manufacturer products, is to manufacture things no one else has thought to do.
You know, one of the questions you raise in the book is whether or not this feeling, the competitive heat from China, is going to prompt this reexamination of space exploration and get us going on a mission to Mars.
Yeah,
what do you think?
I don't know what it's like to have an economic race, you know, because I grew up in the space race, which was military, of course. It'd be interesting if it were an economic race, all right? Suppose China did not say they want to put military bases on the moon, because like I said, if they did that, we'd be there in 9 months, 10 months. Like I said,
right.
A month to build all the space, to fund it and build space, we had 9 months to get there. We'd be so on Mars by now if China leaked a memo saying they want to build military bases there. Plus, Mars is like already red, so it'd be an easy marketing thing in China to get that one done. It'd be interesting to think of it as an economic race, because the urge might be that we all agree this is good for technology, so let's partner together. All right. So that could happen, and that'd be an interesting solution to this. I can't imagine. I mean, China's already eating our lunch economically. We've already lost that, as far as I'm concerned. So really, it's time for us to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps. And it's not about it's too costly. When you're investing, as long as there's a return on that investment, the cost is irrelevant. What you're after is the return. It's the return that matters here.
Here's an email from Tad, who writes, do you think there's a chance for a new program comparable to Sagan's Cosmos to capture society's imagination today? Well, you've got a program in the works.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he knew. Tad is that's a boy name, not a girl name, I guess. And so, Tad, we are right now scripting the next generation, 21st century, 13-episode Cosmos. And I'm serving as the host and executive editor of that series. And it is crafted in the spirit of the original Cosmos, which is now 32 years ago.
Wow.
It's a whole generation ago. I'm partnering with two of the original three creative principals. Carl is dead, of course, but Andrian and Steve Soder. We got Mitch Canold is one of our producers. And we're taking it to Fox. And we intend to air it in primetime on Fox. And what's interesting is because Fox has network, even if it doesn't do well, it'll still have like 10 times the audience it would have had on PBS.
Yeah.
And so we're taking it to the people who never thought to tune into PBS or NPR because it's not in their speed button on their remote control.
And so it's not in their wheelhouse.
It's not there. Yeah. It's just it skips right over. Not everybody listens to NPR and PBS, yeah, and as much as we'd like to think otherwise. Yeah. And the folks who do listen tend to be educated and kind of know that being smart is a good thing. And I don't know that the whole rest of the world feels that way. They enjoy Survivor, and they enjoy wondering what Snooki had for breakfast. So my task as the host of The Next Cosmos is to create a show that has a level of appeal so that it not only will be enjoyed by those who are in the club, but will get the attention of those who never thought to think about the cosmos. And so it's not just science for science's sake. It's science as it matters to you, a citizen of this world. And that was that constituted the strongest points of the original Cosmos series. And we're sort of skimming that philosophy forward. And yes, we're going to throw in some new things we've learned over those years, but that's not the greatest gift that Cosmos was to culture. It was getting a sense of why science matters. Mm.
Less than a minute. Let me ask you this finally. You want to go into space yourself?
Yeah, but, you know, consider, I'll be quick, that I tweeted this once, that if Earth was shrunk to a schoolroom globe,
yeah,
the size of Mars would be a mile away, the moon 30 feet away, space shuttle space station 3/8 of an inch above its surface. Well, if you're going to send me into space, send me somewhere, not just in low Earth orbit.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, the author of several books, including his latest. It's called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Dr. Tyson, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the chat.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Matthew Martin. Radio West produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.